In the texts on vainglory, we find in Book 12 of the Institutes, in which Cashin describes the spirit of pride, a repetition of and something of an application of the material that we've already seen in Evagrius. He describes in Chapter 1 that our final combat is against the spirit of pride, and he says in Chapter 2 that there are two different kinds of pride. One that afflicts those who are relatively new to the spiritual life, and the others who are making spiritual progress, and that the first kind of pride, which has more to do with vainglory, it involves one's relationship with others, and the second, or the most problematic one, has to do with God. And so Cashin will emphasize here what we've already said, that the danger of pride has to do with its disconnecting the self from God, and that the restoration of the self that's been tempted by pride is to put itself back in relationship, to recognize again its dependence on God, and especially its awareness of God's grace. So if we drop down to Chapter 3, he points out that pride, like vainglory, has the power to injure, to destroy, as it were, to corrupt or to corrode all the other virtues. There is a kind of exaltation in the self that itself has the effect of negating the good progress that's been made by coming to greater degrees of self-awareness and working on the other virtues. Chapter 4 is his reminder of the fact that from the standpoint of the Christian traditions concerning the origins of creation and of the world, Lucifer, the devil, was cast down because of the sin of pride. In other words, cast down, found himself separated from God precisely because he chose not to be in relationship with God, not to acknowledge the necessity for grace in all things. And he discusses this in some length in Chapter 4. He then, Cashin goes on in Chapter 5 to suggest that there is a kind of origin in pride of all the kinds of temptations that one has, and that although, he says in Chapter 6, although we describe pride last, nevertheless, because it is connected with, because in a sense it has to do with the root of all the other temptations, it can be regarded as, in some sense, the first. And here, of course, he's alluding in a kind of subliminal way to this story of the first fall, namely the fall of Lucifer, the fall of Satan. The implication here is that, in some sense, all vice represents a kind of turning away from God. All temptations represent a failure to acknowledge the necessity for relying on grace. And so that of which pride is the clearest exponent, of which pride is itself the most powerful symbol, lies in some sense at the heart of all other kinds of sin and falling away as well. He points out in Chapter 7 that the real enemy, or the opposite, or the evil of pride, is such that its adversary is God himself. Pride is specifically the question, do I choose to be in, to recognize my existence as rooted in relationship with God, or do I demand to stand alone, which, as we've mentioned before, is another way of describing the phenomenon of damnation. The existence of hell is precisely the choice to live in separation from God, to live in isolation. And he goes on in Chapter 8 to give biblical texts which support and are a part of this understanding of the origin of sin in pride and the really demonic nature of it. And then in Chapter 9, he gives some very specific remedies. He gives some biblical texts and some notions that we should meditate on that help us return from this temptation to separation, to instead rejoice in and acknowledge and recognize our rootedness in relationship with God. And so he gives, and I've numbered them 1 through 7, several biblical citations. Not I, but the grace of God with me, and by the grace of God I am what I am. This continual repetition of emphasis on grace. The only way to step out of pride is to step into the acknowledgement of our salvation by grace through faith, that it really is the grace and the gift of God that is offered to us and in which our whole existence, our eternal existence, consists and on which it depends. So all of these texts are reminders of the need to be back in relationship with God, to rejoice in and to accept the good gift of God's grace. And please feel free to look at these at your own leisure. Then if we drop down through chapters 10 and 11, he gives more biblical examples of pride and the difficulties that it entails. Then in chapter 12, tries to counteract pride and emphasize grace with a little hint of heaven. All the long years of the present life disappear when we have to regard the eternity of future glory. Our sorrows vanish away in contemplation of that vast bliss. In some ways, he is saying that the alternative to pride, one of the counteractants to pride, is not just to be aware of the concept of grace, this necessity for being in relationship with God, but actually to engage in contemplation of heaven. It is as if heaven is, the contemplation of heaven is part of the cure. It is part of the way of turning away from isolation. I would rather be in, I would rather experience now that state of deepening intimacy and union with God, which is another name for heaven, rather than choosing to be solitary, isolated, separated, sovereign, which is the alternative, which is basically hell. He then goes on in chapter 13 to give the example of obedience to and a willingness to listen carefully to the teachings of those who have gone before one. In other words, to exercise the virtue of obedience, the particular form of humility which is obedience, as a way of growing in one's capacity to resist. And then in chapter 15, he also talks about another reiteration of the necessity of listening to those who have gone before us. In chapter 16, he reiterates that every kind of perfection and growth is undertaken and can only be accomplished with the mercy and the inspiration of God. Without grace, nothing is possible. And in chapter 17, that everything pertaining to salvation is the gift of God. We cannot do anything connected with salvation without God's great gift. And chapter 17 consists of a whole string of biblical citations in support of this. So he continues then in chapters 18 and 19 to talk about the providence, the daily concern of God for us, that we are constantly being taken care of by God. And here we have an echo of something that is very prominent in Evagrius, the logos of providence, the idea that part of our contemplative faculty should be to look at the events and the circumstances of our lives and even the particular struggles that we are having, recognizing that God is providing us with the means for overcoming these. And so grace, while a kind of a theoretical construct, an idea, a concept, is actualized in our being able to acknowledge and perceive, as it were, contemplate the actual form that God's providence, God's daily care, God's intervention on our behalf is taking. And we must be willing to look for this, look at this, and make this a part of our own contemplative effort. So, as we've seen, part of the cure for pride consists in contemplating heaven in the future and in our participation in relationship now, which is a kind of foretaste of heaven, but also acknowledging and deliberately seeing God's action in ordinary events. In chapter 19, another reiteration of the fact that this is part of the tradition that we receive from others. And in chapter 20, a sad tale of a member of a monastic community who is an example of spiritual pride and who is particularly struck with temptation to unchastity. Then an Old Testament example in chapter 21, which we need not spend too much time on, the the recommendation that one not be deceived by pride. Here again, an emphasis on the fact that this really is a kind of temptation to unreality, to not acknowledge the truth and the reality of our life in relationship with God. And in 23 and following, the essential nature of the virtue of humility, of being able to be in a position of acknowledging dependency, of acknowledging relationship. He, in chapter 24, returns to the point that he'd made at the beginning of the conference, that there are these two kinds of pride, one connected with our relationships with one another, and the other particularly having to do with God. And he describes in chapter 25 the terrible example of a monk tempted to disobedience, which in the context of a community where humility consists of obedience, represents a real turning away from the fundamentals of the life that the man who had professed. So finally, in chapter 27, a description of what can result from pride, it being the root of all other kinds of evil. And he continues in this chapter to give specific examples of how a whole variety of inappropriate forms of behavior, giving in to particular kinds of temptations, can spring from this sin. And again, in chapter 28, yet another example of a monk who is cursed with an experience of disobedience. He then continues finally towards the end of the conference in chapter 30 to describe the terrible state of someone who succumbs to pride, and it takes the particular form of their conviction that they should be made a superior. Pride in this context means that rather than being in relationship with God and allowing that to be the source of strength for me and the invitation to recognize my ongoing relationship with others, instead pride convinces me that I ought to be over others, making decisions for them, that my relationship with them ought to be one of condescension, ought to be one of being in charge. And this is the direct result of this, what is for Evagrius the archetypal demonic temptation. In chapter 31, he describes the overcoming of pride and the attainment of perfection as consisting in humility, and the form of humility will of course depend upon one's circumstances. In the monastic context of which Cassian is writing, it particularly takes the form of obedience to authority. And finally, he reiterates again in chapter 32 the destructive nature of pride, and emphasizes again in chapter 33 remedies, although he doesn't list them quite as clearly as he did before, the necessity for humility. But we saw earlier that he particularly recommends meditation on particular passages of the scripture which specially emphasize the importance of reliance upon the grace of God, acknowledgement of one's relationship of being a recipient of grace as a precondition for spiritual progress and for overcoming this very corrosive and destructive temptation.